Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Barack Obama's message to the American voter is clear. He's out on the hustings, and the hustings include the world. And right now, that tough patch of the world, from Israel to Pakistan, that so vexes American foreign policy. He says he's there to listen, and he wants to do things differently. Here he was Sunday in Afghanistan, speaking to CBS.
One of the shifts in foreign policy that I want to execute as president is giving the world a clear message that America intends to continue to show leadership, but our style of leadership is going to be less unilateral.
This hour on Point, Obama's study abroad and the policy options he's surveying from Kabul to Baghdad to Israel and beyond. We're going to look at options and realities in what's been called the arc of instability from the Eastern Mediterranean to Pakistan. But first, joining me from Baghdad is Ned Parker. He's been reporting from Iraq for the Los Angeles Times for much of the last 5 years and covered Obama's flying visit to Iraq. Ned, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Tell us first about Barack Obama's meeting with U.S. commanders in Iraq. ABC's reported that there were some butting of heads there over a timetable for troop withdrawal. What do you know? How do you interpret that conversation?
Can you just specify a bit more? You're talking about regarding Maliki and the Maliki interview with the German weekly Der Spiegel?
Well, Barack Obama says he wants withdrawal in 16 months after he would come into office. Is it known how the U.S. Commanders in Iraq are responding to that proposal?
Well, I mean, it's not known, or it's behind closed doors, but Senator Obama has said that he will consult with commanders on the ground in terms of how they view conditions. And obviously, commanders such as General Petraeus and General Raymond Odierno, who's due to come back to Iraq by the end of the year, talk about the need for U.S. troop presence. It's just a matter of how much, how many forces, and where. So, and I think there's probably room in terms of their discussions to find some common ground.
Let's listen to just a little bit of what Obama had to say. He had a sit-down with General David Petraeus, among others. There has been, of course, criticism from some military brass about that Obama's declared plan for a withdrawal of U.S. forces 16 months, by 16 months, into his presidency, if it should come. In an interview last night, ABC's Terry Moran asked Obama whether General Petraeus discussed those concerns.
I don't think that there are deep concerns about the notion of a pullout per se. There are deep concerns about, from their perspective, a timetable that doesn't take into account what they anticipate might be some sort of changing conditions.
Barack Obama speaking there from Iraq. Ned Parker, what about the Iraqi government? News over the weekend was that they, too, want a timetable. It sounded like they were kind of on the same page as Obama. How is that sorted out?
Well, right. I mean, so much of this is politics, and there's a question of, is the government of Prime Minister Nouri Maliki seeking leverage in negotiations with President George W. Bush's administration about how the context in which U.S. forces would stay in Iraq? So is he seeking leverage? But it's been a long-standing view of the camp of Prime Minister Maliki and others, that they want control of security on the ground in Iraq, and they do not want U.S. forces in the middle of cities. And that even dates back before the surge. The difference now is that, essentially, by the end of the year, the U.N. mandate that allows U.S. forces to play such a big and role in Iraq's security and politics, et cetera, is coming to an end. So no matter what comes next, the Iraqis are going to have much more control. So with Senator Obama talking about a withdrawal of U.S. troops, scaling it down, it meshes on a certain level and with Iraq's needs. And even President Bush last week issued the statement with Prime Minister Maliki about the idea of a time horizon for the drawing down of U.S. forces. So as much as there's a lot of noise because there is an election campaign, I think you could probably make an argument that as Iraq does change, as Iraq regains more and more of its sovereignty, it's in the interest of probably the White House, whether it's President Bush or whoever the president will be next year, and Prime Minister Maliki or whoever is in charge of the Iraqi government, that there is a smaller U.S. role, that there are fewer boots on the ground and a less visible presence. I think at the end of the day, after all of the noise and the spin, that's where Iraq is moving, whoever is in charge of the United States and whoever is in charge of Iraq.
We had the Associated Press quoting Maliki's spokesman, Ali Dabag, yesterday, saying, "We are hoping that in 2010 that combat troops will withdraw from Iraq." Now, 2010, that sounds sort of like 16 months into the next presidency, whoever sits in the Oval Office. What are you hearing from military commanders, military personnel in Iraq, Ned, about Obama's visit? What do they make of it and his perspective on the conflict there?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. I mean, in talks recently with some military-type officials or people associated with the Defense Department, I think there's perhaps more of a sympathy for Senator McCain. That is probably there with many officials associated with the Defense Department. Perhaps that's because he's more of a known quantity. But at the end of the day, I just in different discussions, I think that what you end up hearing is, I mean, the idea or the premise is that Iraq should be in charge of its own destiny. Iraqi security forces should be standing on their own. And that's something that's far more of a reality or a pity than it did 6 or 7 months ago. And the military is a lot of stress right now. There are many mid-level officers dropping out, not staying in. So clearly, it's not on principle that the U.S. military wants to have 100,000 troops in Iraq living in Iraqi cities. I think the sooner that they can draw down, the better. I think that really all sides see the role of U.S. forces in the coming years, whether it's through 2010 or through 2012, is very much that of providing air support, providing advisors to Iraqi units, providing special forces for operations. I think that's the direction everyone is heading.
Ned Parker with the Los Angeles Times in Baghdad. Ned, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We're talking this hour about Barack Obama's study abroad and the options that he is surveying in that big arc from Israel to, well, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Islamabad, you might say. Joining us right now from Washington, retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He was Chief of Staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. Lawrence Wilkerson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
What do you make of Barack Obama's trip so far? He's got a lot more to go. He's in Jordan and Israel today, but he's been through Afghanistan and Iraq, pretty tough spots. What do you make of his performance and the comments coming out of the trip, Colonel Wilkerson?
So far, I think it's been a plus for Senator Obama. I'm struck by something that probably most of your listeners and even some of you people you might interview would not necessarily be struck by, because I spent 31 years as a soldier. I'm amazed at the pictures. I'm encouraged, too, by the pictures that I see of Obama with troops coming across the television. The troops don't look forced to be there like they often do with Vice President Cheney, for example, who seems to like speaking in front of troops more than any other audience in America, reminding me of Caesar, by the way. These troops seem to be genuinely elated to be in Senator Obama's presence and to be talked to by him and to mix and mingle with him. And that's a really good sign, in my view, because I've noted how low the military's morale has been over the last 2 to 3 years. Secretary Gates, of course, has done much to correct that situation, but still, morale amongst the junior officers, junior NCOs, and enlisted personnel in particular, is just not where it used to be, and we need to change that. And I'm encouraged by the fact that they seem to respond to Senator Obama very positively.
You became a tough critic of the Iraq War, but even Barack Obama yesterday, looking at this post-surge Iraq, had to say he was pleased with the progress taking place and said that he felt more optimism about what is happening. Was Obama wrong on the surge, Lawrence Wilkerson?
No, I don't think so. I've pointed out many times, as have others in the military and elsewhere who were striving for reality rather than political trimmings, that many things led to the so-called success of the surge, most of which were begun well before the surge. We had robust U.S. combat operations in early 2007. We had al-Sadr's decision to bring about a ceasefire amongst his most potent militia. We had the Sunni already agreeing that they were going to begin to think about something other than insurgency, and indeed taking on al-Qaeda in Iraq, because they began to detest al-Qaeda in Iraq, realizing that they were killing Muslims as much as they were killing anyone else. So you had all these kinds of things happening before the surge, and David Petraeus walked into the middle of what was a very positive atmosphere conducive to a few additional troops, making stability something that could happen in Baghdad and al-Anbar in particular, but in general across some of the more contentious areas in Iraq. So the surge didn't bring this about. It helped consolidate it, but actions that began well before the surge are really responsible for what's happened in Iraq, not the least of which is a much better strategy.
Lawrence Wilkerson, stand by if you would. We'll look at what John McCain has to say about that. We're looking at Barack Obama's options across a big region. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about Barack Obama's study abroad and the options he's surveying, from Israel to Islamabad, for Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, and the old Middle East there. We've been talking with retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He was Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. We're joined right now from Washington by Zbigniew Brzezinski, former National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter, 1977 to 81. He's a trustee now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Zbigniew Brzezinski, thanks very much for being with us.
It's good to be with you.
So it's a very big region with a lot of conflicts, but do you see it as one that's mired in those conflicts where the circumstances and options are fixed, maybe stuck, or does Barack Obama really have running room here for change?
He certainly does have running room, provided he's determined to correct the kind of policies that have bogged us down for the last several years and have contributed to greater influence and strength of al-Qaeda, which earlier, for example, was not operating out of Iraq. I think we have to disaggregate some of these issues and, in any case, make certain that the United States does not get bogged down in a wide, wide front, which could conceivably range from Iraq through Iran through Afghanistan and even into Pakistan, and thus bog us down for the next 20 years.
Barack Obama is indicating he wants to shift the American focus from Iraq to Afghanistan. He's called that on this trip the, I don't have the exact words here, but the central front in a war on terrorism. Do you think he's right in that? And what about John McCain saying, you know, if you do that too quickly, you could lose a war in Iraq to focus on one in Afghanistan?
I don't think we would lose the war in Iraq because the Iraqis have never been tied up with al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda established a presence for a while in Iraq as a consequence of the U.S. intervention, which then turned many Iraqis violently against the United States, and thus Al-Qaeda became appealing to some of them. But Al-Qaeda never really was based on Iraq, derived from Iraq. It came into Iraq because of the U.S. intervention. In Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda had a refuge. It had a presence there. It exploited the hospitality of Taliban to strike against us. We were fully justified in responding as we did. But I think we have to be very, very careful not to over-militarize our efforts in Afghanistan, because if we do, there is a real risk that the Afghans might react against us the way they reacted against the Soviets. Fortunately, till now, they are viewed us as allies. They remember we helped them against the Soviets. But we essentially militarize our presence in Afghanistan and wage a war which will increasingly mobilize the Afghans against us. We could find ourselves mired down.
Lawrence Wilkerson, look at Iraq and Obama with us for a second. You were chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, who, of course, was a big commanding general himself at one time. Obama was asked yesterday whether he was up against resistance from U.S. military commanders in Iraq to his 16-month pullout plans, and he said he didn't want to get trapped in a false choice between a rigid timetable for withdrawal and completely deferring his words to the recommendations of military commanders. Do you think he's going to meet resistance there? And what should a president, potentially a President Obama, do if he does, Colonel Wilkerson?
Let me just say first that I agree with Mr. Brzezinski, and the use of American air power in Afghanistan in particular disturbs me mightily. We create more enemies by using our air power as indiscriminately sometimes as we do in Afghanistan than we take care of our enemies. So I would like to see that conflict less militarized too and more involved with economic assistance, reconstruction, and so forth. On your question, I was somewhat taken aback by your conversation with Ned Parker in Baghdad, referring to General Petraeus and General Odierno and others. Being a member of the military for 31 years, I'm very, very, very much aware of our civil-military relations concept in this country. And if Obama were president or McCain were president, I would expect General Petraeus and General Odierno to voice their best advice, but then to salute and to march under whatever new orders they might receive. So I'm particularly disappointed if I see a serving active duty general taking exception, even before someone might become president, to what someone is saying about future policy. So I expect the military officers to either do what they're told to do or to resign. I mean, that's the way we operate in this country, I hope.
Let's listen to just a little bit of that exchange between Terry Moran and Barack Obama. This is in Iraq. There was the question of the troop surge in the background since it's been considered pretty successful. In that interview on ABC, Terry Moran was about to ask, giving the chance to do it all over again, but Obama saw the question coming and, thinking about the view of U.S. commanders there, headed him off at the pass.
What I will refuse to do, and I think that
how do you know what I'm going to ask?
Well, then if I don't get it right, then you can ask it again. Is to get boxed in into what I consider two false choices, which is either I have a rigid timeline of such and such a date, come hell or high water, we've gotten our combat troops out, and I am blind to anything that happens in the intervening 6 months or 16 months. Or, alternatively, I am completely deferring to whatever the commanders on the ground says, which is what George Bush says he's doing, in which case I'm not doing my job as commander-in-chief.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, what do you hear this candidate doing right there? He says he doesn't want to get boxed in, locked into false choices between his own promise of 16 months and out and deference to commanders on the ground. How do you hear that?
I hear him sounding very presidential. I think he defined precisely what his responsibility is. His responsibility, when he becomes president, is to set general national strategy. General national strategy cannot be set by field commanders. Go back to the Korean War. General MacArthur would have liked us to go against China. Go to the Vietnamese War. General Westmoreland would have liked us to go into Cambodia, which we eventually did. Field commanders always deal with the local situation. Their job is to win locally. The job of the commander-in-chief and the president is to assess the overall significance of the undertaking and how it fits into American national security policy.
Looking at Obama's options, if indeed he's the guy sitting in the Oval Office, do you think he can deliver on out of Iraq, combat troops out, in 16 months from his...
I do think so, but I also feel that it is not only a military decision. The president, of course, will give the orders, the military will execute. But in addition to giving that order, some other things have to be done, and particularly two major undertakings. We really have to engage the entire spectrum of Iraqi political leadership in a discussion of the modalities and timetable for the disengagement. And it's a good thing that this discussion has started with Maliki, and it's encouraging that Maliki agrees with Obama's timetable. Secondly, we have to talk to all of Iraq's neighbors about getting together, organizing some sort of a conference that enhances the prospects for Iraqi security, for Iraqi recovery, and for security and stability in the region. Every one of Iraq's neighbors has an interest in any aftermath of the American disengagement not spilling over into their own countries and creating problems for them. So all of them would be willing to participate, in my judgment, but only once they know that we're leaving for sure. Most of them, practically none of them, will participate in any regional conference if they think it's sponsored by the U.S. as an occupying power.
And what's to keep Iraq from sliding back into the kind of chaos we saw several years ago if U.S. troops go?
I think the phase of disintegration has gradually come to an end. One can lock oneself by apocalyptic fears into staying on a course over the abyss eventually. Remember the war in Vietnam? Everybody predicted that there would be falling dominoes all over the place. Yes, you can become a prisoner of apocalyptic fears and as a result never be able to disengage.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, a former National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter, joining us from Washington. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you. Bye.
Lawrence Wilkerson, let's go to our callers. BK is calling from Walpole, Massachusetts. BK, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. The last guest really hit the nail. This goes to the early saying that is the sword mightier than the pen. That's the exact difference between both Obama and McCain. McCain is always singing bomb, 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 bomb Iran, whereas Obama says first pen and then the sword. That's why he's able to get this whole international crowd backing him up. And I would like to have more thoughts, and I'll take off from the radio.
BK, thanks very much. Lawrence Wilkerson, how about it? Can we really afford to pull out the military piece of American presence as much as is being suggested here? Out of Iraq in 16 months, more diplomacy than military in Afghanistan, you and Zbigniew Brzezinski are saying. I mean, this is a tough region. Is talk really going to do it? Is the pen really mightier than the sword here?
Well, first of all, if let's just hypothesize for a moment that the opposite is the answer, that is to say military force is what is necessary, then I present you as a military officer who was a strategist and a planner for 31 years with the proposition that we don't have the forces to do it, nor do we have the money to do it. So we've got to go to the draft. We've got to conscript maybe 5, maybe 6 million men and women, and we've got to be prepared to stay on the Arabian Peninsula and possibly in Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan for the next decade. That's nonsense in my view. It's politically impossible. One of the greatest attributes of the demise of empire is biting off more than you can chew. So the first reality is we can't do it with military force, regardless of what people like John McCain say for political reasons. John knows differently, but he's got to do this for political reasons. So you're left with the other tools at our disposal, diplomacy, economics, finance, culture, and so forth. That's what we have to use, and we have to use them very carefully and very adroitly. And I agree with Mr. Brzezinski wholeheartedly that we need to use them with Turkey, with Iran, with Syria, with Afghanistan and Pakistan, with Jordan, with Saudi Arabia. We've got to have people whose vested interest in the region are even more poignant than our own involved in the final solution. So, yes, we can leave Iraq. We may leave some residual force for a time. It'll be probably small, and it'll be helpful only in crisis. But the real issue, I think, is far more strategic and far more fundamental, and that is getting American boots off of Arab soil and going after the real people who struck us on 9/11, and they live in Pakistan in the federally administered tribal areas and occasionally in Afghanistan. That's where Obama is right about the shift of strategic emphasis.
Let's take a call from Jamal in Hampton, New Hampshire. Jamal, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to comment on one of your speakers that had earlier spoken regarding not giving the surge the credit for the improvements, the current improvements. And I just wanted to say, I mean, some of the strategy changes that can be credited to the improvement would not have happened without the surge. My son spent 15 months there, and during the period of when the surge built up, I mean, as the troops came in, it was a noticeable difference where people were actually able to get out into the neighborhoods, involved with the people. Those extra troops is what allowed other troops to get involved with the people in the neighborhoods to talk to the Sunni leaders and, you know, talk to the people out on the streets, the civilians, and, you know, interact with them. And without that, it would not have worked. And if it wasn't a surge that should get the credit, then why are we talking about a surge in Afghanistan? Why don't we just do the same policies in Afghanistan? Well, we can, but we need the extra troops to do it. I mean, you know, it just seems to me that there's a lot of people trying to protect Barack Obama from admitting that he was wrong. It takes a big man to admit when you're wrong about something. He claims he's right about being wrong to go in Iraq, and he may be very well right. But after the fact, when you have the situation we had, it was a total disaster. You know, it was wrong to oppose the surge. If we had opposed the surge, I don't think we'd be where we are today.
Jamal, let us pick that up. That was the message from Senator John McCain yesterday. He was in Kennebunkport, Maine, with George H.W. Bush, Bush the senior, former president, slamming Senator Obama for his opposition to that surge, all part of a message he's trying to drive home that he, not Obama, would make the better wartime president.
When you win wars, troops come home, and we are winning. And the fact is, if we'd have done what Senator Obama wanted to do, we would have lost, and we would have faced a wider war.
Lawrence Wilkerson, there's John McCain, and before him, Jamal, whose son has been in Iraq, both saying, look, we needed this surge. Maybe things were going in a more promising direction, but it was the presence of American troops that made it possible. What do you say?
Well, my son was in Iraq, too. In fact, he came home in November, so he was there through much of the initiation of the surge. I didn't say the surge wasn't a working thing. I said there were things that happened before the surge that made the surge seem more successful than perhaps it was. That was al-Sadr's decision not to continue to bring his most potent militia into the fray. That was the Sunni decision to combat al-Qaeda and to begin to form what's now called the Sons of Iraq. And it was a number of other decisions that were made by external characters like Saudi Arabia and Iran to temper their support of various elements in Iraq that made David Petraeus's strategy, which was finally a good strategy for a counterinsurgency, amenable to the situation, particularly in al-Anbar province, and made it work. So, yes, I will agree with your caller that the additional troops were helpful in the fact that they were able then to consolidate this new situation and to bring a swifter, an accelerated approach of the new strategy. A surge in Afghanistan is a different matter altogether, and I agree again with Mr. Brzezinski that to militarize that conflict too much more than it already is not necessarily a positive thing. But what you have in Afghanistan is an alliance at work, NATO. And by the way, if we fail in Afghanistan, we can write NATO off. And the NATO partners, by and large, to varying degrees, are not holding up their end of the bargain with regard to what's supposed to be happening in Afghanistan. So additional American troops is not like a surge in Iraq. We're actually talking about putting American troops there to do what NATO allies are not doing. So it's a very different situation in terms of the theater and the operations on the ground.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Barack Obama's big tour abroad and the options he's surveying in the tough patch he's been in the last few days, from Israel to Islamabad, looking at his options for Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, and the old Middle East. Barack Obama headed later today to Israel in Amman, Jordan, this morning with a press conference and this observation.
I think that the judgments that I've made over the course of the last 2 years are ones that match up with the reality on the ground. And ultimately, I think that's where U.S. foreign policy is going to have to go.
We've been joined in this hour by retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Secretary of State Colin Powell's right-hand man and friend for 16 years, former director of the U.S. Marine Corps War College at Quantico in Virginia, joining us from Washington. We're joined right now as well by Marwan Washer. He's former foreign minister of Jordan, where Barack Obama's been today, as well as former deputy prime minister, former ambassador of Jordan to the United States. He's author of The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation. Marwan Washer, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let us look at the what we in this country call the Mideast problem for a moment. Israel, the Palestinians, and the tough neighbors there. Do you see new options under a potential Obama administration for the problem in the territories and country right next door to you there in Jordan between Israel and the Palestinians? Are there new options that he could grasp?
I certainly do. I think it's been very unfortunate that the United States in the last 7 years has focused its attention on the Middle East, primarily on Iran and Afghanistan, and has compartmentalized the issue and almost forgot the number one issue on the radar screen of all the region, which is the Arab-Israeli conflict. I think that there is a new opportunity with a new president coming and looking at a situation where a solution to the conflict has already been negotiated among the parties themselves. We are not today in search of a solution. We're search of a political will by a new U.S. administration to put that solution into effect. And I hope that an Obama presidency or a McCain presidency would look fresh at the problems of the region and would just change the mindset and the goalposts and understand that if that conflict remains, the cause of frustration that it will have will feed into Al-Qaeda and it will feed into all the violent and radical positions that we're seeing in the region today.
Last month, Barack Obama spoke to the annual policy conference of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. He got 14 standing ovations, one of the biggest when he said in this tape that Jerusalem should be Israel's undivided capital.
Israel's security is sacrosanct. It is non-negotiable. The Palestinians need a state. The Palestinians need a state that is contiguous and cohesive, and that allows them to prosper. But any agreement with the Palestinian people must preserve Israel's identity as a Jewish state with secure, recognized, defensible borders. And Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel, and it must remain undivided.
Barack Obama on June 4th, speaking to AIPAC, he came back and qualified that, saying by undivided he meant he didn't want barbed wire and walls. But Lawrence Wilkerson, what do you make of that statement by Obama before AIPAC, and does that sound like the foundation for a new way on this front, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict front?
Politics before a very powerful American lobby group. That's how I make it. I think we were as close as we've come to a final solution ever with Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, Dennis Ross, and others towards the end of Clinton's administration. We had borders, we had capital, we had right of return, we had all the issues pretty much worked out. Conventional wisdom is that Arafat and the Arabs threw that threw a monkey wrench into that. My wisdom is that Ehud Barak shared in that monkey wrench. We could come there again, but we aren't going to do it with the Bush administration. As one op-ed writer said this morning, Dr. Rice is involved in legacy-building exercises, not substantive diplomacy. I hope that either McCain or Obama, were they to become president, would put that at the near the top of their agenda, and that is a fresh approach to the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian issue, and that they would be able to achieve that final result that Clinton was so tantalizingly close to.
But what is a fresh approach in that case, Colonel Wilkerson? I mean, Bill Clinton was there, a lot of effort put into it, it didn't work. George Bush turned away pretty resoundingly for a long time.
Well, the first thing Bush negated that Clinton had was, and I think Bush's policies and our policies in general have aided and abetted this process, is we have no political leader in Israel right now. We have as close to political chaos in Israel as we've had in a long time. We have Ehud Olmert involved in scandals that look very much like they're going to bring him down at any moment. We have a military disconnect between the political leadership and the leadership of the military in terms of what might or might not be possible with regard to Iran. I talk to Israelis nearly every week. They don't believe they have a political leadership that could make a decision right now, even if Israel were to somehow come under a crisis situation where they had to. So we have, in effect, aided and abetted this process of making sure that the political leadership in Israel has both hands tied behind its back and can't do anything. So the very first thing we need is a political leadership in Israel that has the support of its people and that can move in a direction. And we need to be an honest broker to that move and not, as Aaron David Miller has said, play the role of Israel's lawyer.
Here's Barack Obama again this morning in Amman, Jordan, talking about just this problem.
An ultimate resolution is going to involve two states standing side by side in peace and security. And that the Israelis and the Palestinians are going to both have to make compromises in order to arrive at that two-state solution.
Marwan Muasher, former Jordanian ambassador to the United States, you said earlier that you think there's already a solution out there. Maybe this is at the heart of it, the two-state solution, but even Barack Obama is saying there's going to have to be a lot more compromise. It doesn't look so obvious that there's a solution waiting to just be grasped by the next president, whoever that may be.
I totally agree with Mr. Wilkinson. First, that there is a solution that has already been negotiated among the two parties, the Palestinians and the Israelis themselves. But I would add to that that since then, in 2002, the whole Arab world committed to a collective peace treaty with Israel and security guarantees for Israel in return for a two-state solution and the Golan, the Golan Heights and the Shabaa Farms back to Arab sovereignty. In other words, we have today a framework for a solution, not between a weak Israeli government and a weak Palestinian government, but between Israel and the whole of the Arab world. And I think that if Mr. Obama or Mr. McCain is to look at this problem afresh, they would see that there is a golden opportunity here to bring peace to the whole region, thereby removing a central cause of frustration from the region. Today, we are not talking about an imposed solution. We are talking about a solution that has been negotiated between the parties, that is agreed to between the whole Arab world and Israel. And I think that if the United States is to look at this problem from a fresh perspective, it can provide the political will needed to bring about such a solution very quickly. If we don't do that, I'm afraid that we would only be feeding the cause of radicalism and we would be dealing with radicals in the Arab world for a very long time to come.
I want to get back closer to the other end of this region, Pakistan, Afghanistan. But in the middle, we've got Lawrence Wilkerson, Iran, sitting. The U.S., of course, sent William Burns to the talks in Geneva. And then we hear nothing really came out of that, as Condoleezza Rice portrays it. Iran working on its nuclear program. Israel very uncomfortable with that. No small number of people in Washington uncomfortable with that. Do you see new options for Barack Obama again, if he should take the White House with Iran, or just the same old long, slow game of chess that appears to be moving toward Iranian nuclear weaponry?
I think if we have a new leader in the White House who takes the right approach, I think we do have the opportunity, and not just with Persia, with Iran, but with the region in general. One of our staunchest allies in the region, Turkey, is going through, as you know, a great deal of political turmoil right now. But what disturbs me more than anything else is that in the latest polling, less than 15% of the Turks believe the United States is a trustworthy country anymore. That's devastating. We need to talk to everyone in the region, including Tehran. We need to talk bilaterally, and we need to talk multilaterally, because the only way we're going to bring solution to some of these problems, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, ultimately the problem of the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz and the security of Israel, which are fundamental, is to talk to the people in the region who have a vested interest in stability, a vested interest in economic prosperity, and so forth. And you don't do that with bombs, bullets, and bayonets. You do that by sitting down. Now, the word is coming to me from the State Department that Bill Burns, while he's the number three and did go along with Solana, really didn't have a whole lot of marching instructions for this other than to keep his mouth shut. That's a very interesting way to negotiate, even if you say you're not negotiating. That's a hell of a way to do it. That reminds me of the six-party talks when Jim Kelly, then Assistant Secretary for East Asia and Pacific, was put in a straitjacket before he went to talk with the North Koreans. This is not the way to conduct diplomacy. It seems that we're trying to give the image, the rhetoric of diplomacy, while holding out the sword and being expectant of its use. I hope that's not the case. I hope that what we had was a meaningful dialogue, to which eventually, and the Persians are very slow usually in responding to these sorts of things, they will respond, and I hope their response is positive. But I'm not hearing good things about this from the State Department.
Ambassador Mwasher, you were former foreign minister of Jordan. Do you doubt that Iran is working hard toward becoming a nuclear-armed power? Do you think that if it's doing that, it can be talked off of that, or is it more determined than that?
Well, I start by saying that if we think that a military solution is going to either stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon or solve the problem, then all we need to look at is Iraq and see whether the military solution there was able to solve the problem. Again, I find myself in total agreement with Lawrence that if the military solution is not an option to solve the problem, then it seems to me that the only other option you have is through dialogue. You have to talk to your enemies. That is the only way you can solve results. And, you know, we've seen that happen with North Korea. We've seen that happen with Libya. I don't see why it can't happen with Iran. But to assume that you're going to solve the problem by not talking to Iranians seems to me rather odd.
Let's go to Drew, calling from Boston. Hi, Drew. You're on the air.
Hi, nice to talk to you. My point relates more to what you were talking about earlier with Palestine and Barack Obama's comments about it recently. I just got back from the West Bank. I was there for a few months working for a fair trade olive oil company, and I was there when President Bush held the Annapolis conference, which was a complete disaster, not so much in the geopolitical sense, but more in the sense that before any of the projects related to Annapolis got off the ground, I heard from both Israeli and Palestinian citizens that both thought it was a complete disaster. And it goes back to sort of looking at the leadership that's involved on all three sides of this issue, Bush, Olmert, and Abbas, all of who don't really have much support in their own countries, let alone in the international community. And I'm terrified right now because it seems, as someone who's going to vote for Barack Obama, it seems that what he's doing is following in Bush's footsteps, pandering to AIPAC, and not really taking the abuse that the Palestinians have suffered in the past 60 years as a serious issue.
So you see options for him there or not, that as an American president, he's likely to stay on a similar trail?
Yeah, I think that he is going to stay on a similar trail, and I do think that there are options once he reaches office, but I understand that it would probably something be very close to political suicide not to pander to AIPAC. But what worries me is that AIPAC, being one of the most powerful lobbying groups in the country, could actually be powerful enough to not allow Barack Obama to change his stance once he gets into office. I mean, it was maybe almost a year ago now when Barack Obama said, "No one has suffered like the Palestinians." And I believe that he meant something similar to what I would mean if I said that, which is that for the past 60 years, the Palestinians have been a dispossessed people without a homeland. And then when he came under fire from AIPAC, he said, "Oh, well, what I mean was, yes, the Palestinians have suffered, but that suffering is self-inflicted."
Drew, we've got your view, and thanks for your call. Lawrence Wilkerson, Ambassador Mwasher, I mean, if Barack Obama should take office in January, he's still going to have Hamas sitting there, Hezbollah sitting there, Al-Qaeda and the trouble along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, Iran. You've both talked a lot about talk and diplomacy as the way out of it, but Lawrence Wilkerson, can talk really resolve these problems when you've got such committed, kind of hardcore opponents on many fronts?
Well, it's not just talk, as we've seen from the six-party negotiations. It's not just talk. Diplomacy does not involve just talk. If it does, it's usually fruitless.
Mm-hmm.
It involves quid pro quos. I mean, the North Korean terminology is action for action. I think that's pretty good. And it translates that way from the Korean, too. When you do something, they have to do something, and when they do something, you have to do something. So you're not going to Tehran just to talk. You're going to assure them that you will recognize them as the power that they should be recognized as. Indeed, as the power we recognize them as, the hegemon of the Gulf, for 26 years when we had our tyrant in charge of them. So you're giving them security guarantees. You're telling them that they can make more money. You're telling them they can be more prosperous. You're telling them they can interface with the world's greatest economy. You're telling them that you might even have access to the WTO. They might even become members of the WTO, as China has become, much to its economic benefit. You're telling them all sorts of things, and then you're following through with it, so that trust builds and so forth. So this is not just talking. This is exchanging powerful instruments of assurance and trust. We've sort of lost that knack. We don't do diplomacy very well anymore, much to my chagrin. We need to get back in the game.
Ambassador Mosher, headline in the New York Times today, Mideast sees more of the same if Obama is elected. We've just got 20 seconds, sir. You think more of the same under an Obama administration or something new?
Well, I hope it's something new, whether Mr. Obama or Mr. McCain get elected, and I hope that if they realize what the problems of the region are and what the frustration is, I hope that they will look at it anew, as I said. I don't think that we need to go through another 4 or 8 years of the status quo in the Middle East. That would be disastrous, not just for the interests of the Middle East, for the interests of Israel and for the interests of the United States.
Ambassador Mosher and Lawrence Wilkerson, thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.